Got stubborn spots, unwanted hair, or uneven skin? The CAPS Laser Center offers advanced solutions. They offer a full range of advanced laser treatments like Halo and Moxie that help reveal smoother, clearer, healthier-looking skin. CAPS is one of the top providers in the world for laser treatments, and their expert team delivers personalized care every step of the way. When you book your first Laser Center appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. So don't wait. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
Why do we say Gesundheit?
What's the longest German word?
And do you know your ablaut from your umlaut?
Grab your rucksack, knapsack, or haversack. Let's go to kindergarten and learn a thing or two about German terms that have made their way into the English zeitgeist on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Willkommen to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of etymology books, including Useless Etymology. And today we are visiting you on your current home turf, are we not?
Yes, we are. We are covering the German words that have somehow found their way into English, or for whatever reason, regularly trip off the tongue of us English speakers. There's a bit of nuance there that will become clear.
I am looking forward to this one. So where should we start on our German journey?
Well, I think we should start with the sort of obvious borrowings from German, the ones that people, you just look at it, oh, that's well German, that. Whereas like Doppelgänger, for example, yes. You know, a double walker, quite literally, or a mm-hmm. double goer. If you ever meet your doppelganger, someone who is exactly like you, then is it, you'll perish, I think is the story. I mean, you don't want to meet them. Basically, but words like that, for example.
Why not go into that for a second? Because the original English sense was ghostly, right? The apparition or spirit of double of a living person.
Which is interesting, isn't it? Because another of the big words from German is poltergeist, which
yes.
literally just means a noisy ghost. I think in American English, you potentially use more German words than we do over here, which doesn't seem to make much sense just in terms of our proximity to Germany. I say over here, I mean in Britain, obviously. I know I'm in Germany, but just because of the nature of America's makeup and the many Europeans who made up the early settlers there.
Yeah, and German folks encountered sort of a bit of bias in some of the early days of the migration into what is now the United States, to being sort of isolated. And like the German language was also sort of maligned in some states and regions as well. In the early 19th century, there was a sort of a concerted attempt to prevent people from learning German.
But nevertheless, there are quite a lot of German speakers still in America. I mean, there are dialects of German that exist in America, right? Pennsylvania Dutch and the like. But I when I was talking about words that you use, the idea that you use more over there is, for example, we don't say Gesundheit in Britain when someone sneezes. We say bless you, which is just, by the way, Gesundheit means, well, healthiness,
yes.
Really, in German. And you also say it here when someone sneezes. In fact, I would say Germans are almost militant about saying Gesundheit when someone sneezes. Like, if you do sneeze in public here, you can feel pretty certain that someone is going to wish you good health, which is rather nice, I think.
I've got to bring Drew over there because he has like 7 sneezes in him in any given go. So by the end, I'm just like, curse you.
I just have one massive sneeze. I've sort of grown into my dad and it's gigantic now, my sneeze. But I always enjoy
sneeze.
Saying Gesundheit to other people here. I've really taken that one on.
Funny enough, the Gesund in German and Gesundheit is related to the English word sound, as in healthy or safe, but it is also convenient that it's a loud sound.
Right. I had no idea about that one. That's fascinating, isn't it? Because you have this way of making nouns by putting a G in front of them that was also common in English, old English, but we've dropped a lot of the G's in there. For example, a drink in German is a Eingetränk, which is just taking the verb and putting a g in front of it, turning it into a noun.
We see that in Old English as well. It was usually a y sound, yeah, but it's a sound. GE at the beginning.
The relationship between German and English is worth pointing out, isn't it? They're siblings, as languages go. We're actually fairly closely related to German in that we are West Germanic languages. Yeah, us, the Low Countries languages like Dutch, Flemish, Low German as well, closely related to English and indeed Old English. I've said this before and I stand by it. I think a German has a better chance of understanding Old English than a modern English speaker, just because
It
also had the three grammatical genders, the same four case system, although Old English did have a fifth case early on, but it definitely has a very, very sort of German feel to it, Old English. But there's sort of little translations you can do. I made a video about this a few years ago, but it's a very popular video that I made where I sort of told you how to cheat translating German into English by swapping consonants around, because German, what we call German, what's actually called High German, really, went through a very specific process, a consonant shift that was consistent. That means you can actually swap them around. I'm seeing a dog there, ein Hund. Yeah.
Excuse me.
you just lug that dog away while I explain the consonant shifts. War süß, so sehr süß. So, for example,
continue.
A lot of German words that begin with a D, their English equivalent begins with a th sound, talking about words like das, which is that.
Oh,
in
yeah.
English. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, there are absolutely loads of these. Hold on. I've got a whole list of them. Three is drei in German. Thunder is Donner in German. Thing is Ding in German. But there are lots of these. For example, you can swap T's in English for S sounds in German. For example, you get water becomes Wasser and what is Was. See, and obviously the sort of V and W thing is also going on. P's and F's. Sometimes a P in English becomes a F sound in German. The words Pfeffer and Pfeiffer, which means pepper and pipe, are double whammies on that. But also Hoffer is hope and Apfel is apple. Oh yeah, W's and Y's in English somehow become G's in German. For example, a bow in English is Bogen.
Oh, excellent.
In German, mm-hmm. Yeah. Or day is obviously Tag, which combines two things there because you also have this DT switch thing. Well, I just like pointing those things out because actually, if you're aware that German went through it was German that sort of diverged away, High German that diverged away from the other West Germanic languages with this particular second Germanic vowel consonant shift, as it's sometimes called, then it does actually help you translate the words. If you know that, oh, hold on, if in High German they're using this consonant, perhaps it's this consonant in our language, and sometimes it'll get you there.
The elaborate compounds can make German seem intimidating, but if you break them all down, the vocabulary isn't that hard to understand.
By its very nature, the compounding avoids you having to create complicated words, right? As in long words, borrow long words or invent new words. By compounding, you can use small, simple elements to make longer concepts. So though they look really complicated, they're not. We should talk about some of the sort of famously long German words then, mm-hmm. shouldn't we? There are a couple that they talk about over here. One of them was, this was a genuine meat labeling law enforced between 1999 and 2013 in the Bundesland, the state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern or Mecklenburg-Western Pomerania. And it was the Rindfleisch-Etikettierungs-Überwachungs-Aufgaben-Übertragungsgesetz.
It's a mouthful.
Or one word. Yeah, it is. But actually, if you break it down, you've got Rindfleisch, which is literally beef meat, Etikettierung, which is labeling, Überwachung, which is, I suppose, monitoring, supervision, Aufgaben is duties, Übertragungsgesetz is, yeah, delegation law. It's not as complicated as, I mean, it's still quite complicated, but it's not that bad. Have I sold it? Okay, maybe I can sell it on the other popular example given here. It's actually shorter. But this was theoretically an actual job, although the person who had this job between, well, the people that had this job between 1829 and 1991, is it? I might have misnoted down that date. They technically could have called themselves this, but I don't think they ever did. It's Donaudampfschifffahrtsgesellschaftskapitän.
Sounds painful.
All one word. Yeah, it's not that complicated. Again, Donau is just the Danube. Dampfschiff is a steam boat. Dampf is steam. Schiff is ship. Fahrt is journey. Don't laugh.
I'm always going to laugh, Rob.
Is society. And Kapitän is captain. So you get Donau Dampfschifffahrtsgesellschaftskapitän. My point is it looks absolutely disgusting. When you break it down, it's not that hard.
Absolutely disgusting is not the word that I would have applied to that. Sounds complicated.
I recently had to fill in some legal documents because for some reason life here requires you to do this quite often. And the length of the words in that document, it is disgusting. I would describe it as when you actually see it and you feel sick. I think, oh, I've got to work out what on earth this means. Luckily, once you've deciphered it, it will tell you precisely what that concept is. You know, it won't be some odd borrowing from Latin or from French that has a very complicated meaning, but is actually quite a short word. No, it'll be a nice long word to explain quite a complicated concept, but the word itself will explain it.
Yeah, our bureaucracy tends to distance itself from its actual meaning by putting it in Latin. Whereas this is more approachable in many ways once you get past the intimidation of the gigantic words.
Yeah, this came up in our recent Latin episode as well, particularly in medicine and science as well. In medicine, it's a really good way of obscuring quite a horrible diagnosis. Yes. with the words that you borrow from a classical language instead.
Is there a rule to the order in which you put your compounds?
I bet there is, but I've never sat down to learn it.
Because it seems like you could make any word by compiling German words into one compound, but I also don't know, like, I would probably do it out of order.
For example, in German sentences, and in a way that we don't necessarily have to do here, you have to order the information that you're giving a certain way. That it's time, manner, place. So to speak German properly, you have to say when the thing is going to happen before you say how it's going to happen and where it's going to happen in the sentence. And then usually you finish it off with the verb so that people know what's going on there.
We do have like unspoken rules for that in English too. We don't like think about it, but until like when we describe things with multiple adjectives, for example, we put them in a similar order, I think.
I don't think English learners are, as a matter of course, taught that concept.
Right.
They tend to find it out from social media later. Well, yeah, we definitely aren't. Growing up, you just know, don't you? But in German lessons, I have been taught the order in which these things have to happen. So at least they're aware of it and conscious of it. Didn't explain it, but that's the deal.
These compounds have also created, I think we've addressed before, and I suppose we don't have to rehash, but they end up being translated into acronyms pretty frequently, right?
Yeah. They're not quite acronyms, but you take the first two letters of each element. Like it tends to be words. Like I'm thinking about the really famous department store here. It's called KDW, which is Kaufhaus des Westens. Aldi, which you've got in the States, yeah. Right? Uh-huh. Is Albrecht Discounts. It's a very popular way of making brand names.
Adidas as well, which we've discussed before, was Adidasler. I mean, that's a name, but still it's a similar principle. Then
it's
the word
worth pointing out that
right?
Isn't an, it's not an acronym. There's some people think right. It is.
But FLAC, the word FLAC as well, is from German. And it's short for Fliegerabwehrkanone. It means aircraft defense cannon. And FLAC first came into English in 1938 as a term for an anti-aircraft gun. And the elements are pilot, defense, warding off, and cannon.
That's so good.
And then by the 1940s, FLAC also meant the anti-aircraft fire itself, especially the exploding shells that burst around the aircrafts in the air. And then it's catching FLAC comes from that kind of like shrapnel damage.
Oh, that's such a good one. I didn't know about that. It is worth mentioning that there were a couple of wars in the 20th century involving the Germans, and they did involve a lot of vocabulary exchange.
Ersatz is another one as well, which came in during the First World War. The Allied naval blockade of Germany restricted imports and forced Germany and Austria-Hungary to develop substitutes for food and fuel and chemical compounds and things like that. And so ersatz products were sold in Germany during the war. They might use like roasted acorns and chicory and beech nuts for coffee, for example, and you would tap tech ersatz to the front of the word, ersatz coffee. And so now that's our word for like any fake thing or fake product.
Whereas really it's just a replacement. It doesn't have to be inferior, but in English it carries the idea of inferiority, doesn't it? I don't think we were using the word blitz before the Second World War. I might be wrong about that. From Blitzkrieg, which is lightning war. We talk about things being kaputt. That's German for broken. I wonder whether some of these words, I don't think any of the ones we've mentioned so far, but some of the words, it's difficult to know whether we got them from German directly or from Yiddish, which is the language of the Ashkenazi Jews, right? A lot of whom found themselves in sort of New York area speaking a form of High German. I think it's fair to call it that. It's hard to, you know, if you're careful when categorizing languages in relation to others. But certainly words like Schwitz, which is German for sweat, but if we talk about sweating and we say Schwitz, I think we're actually invoking the Yiddish word rather than the German word. When we talk about a Mensch, Mensch is German for person, but again, we've probably got it from Yiddish speakers rather than from German speakers.
That also had to have taken off with like the notion of the Übermensch, right?
I've no idea, because it tends to be used nicely, doesn't it? You say someone's a real Mensch. I don't know if people would be calling on the dialectic of the Nazis when they did that.
Yes, but it's originally a Nietzsche thing.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Anyway, but Uber, there we go. We borrowed Uber
but,
as well.
But you know, what you've touched on there that's really interesting is that we have the areas of philosophy, the areas of linguistics, and the areas of psychology are particularly rich with German borrowings,
yes,
aren't they?
They sure are.
Tell us about some linguistic ones.
I wanted to bring up Zeitgeist, which I think is a big one. This is the general like intellectual or moral or cultural climate of an era, and it means time spirit in German. This comes from German philosopher Johann Gottfried Herder, who coined this in the 1760s, and then Thomas Carlyle brought it into English. And it's the Zeit bit, the time bit, is also cognate with, well, I mean, just like time is with tide.
Yeah, that's another good consonant swap. The t sound in German for just a t sound, t sound in English.
And then Geist, which we also saw in Poltergeist, is ghost or spirit, right?
Yeah, but also there are terms like Angst, right, which is just German for fear, really, but it's just got that extra little existential element in English that it doesn't really have in German.
Kierkegaard and Freud, thanks.
Yeah, Gestalt. These are all words that come from psychology, really. We talk about the Gestalt of something, the sort of combined whole, is from a German word meaning the shape or the form. But we tend to use it in, again, a rather more haughty way in English.
I've heard Weltschmerz before in English. World pain, the deep sadness or weariness born from the gap between the world as it is and the world one believes it ought to be. It means world pain.
And this is the thing that we often attribute to German, is a great ability to express emotions that we don't have words for of our own. Obviously, Schadenfreude, I would argue, is just part of English now, Schadenfreude.
Yeah, absolutely it is.
It's used so much. But I think you can have Freudenfreude, where it's where you feel someone else's joy. Fremdscham is a good one, which is where you feel the shame of someone else on their behalf.
We got Wanderlust from German as well, but we did, because we have the same words, we just treat it the same.
Yeah, that's right. We do, don't we? Yeah, that's interesting. But it's not exactly the same thing. Like, because Freud used the term Lustprinzip, which we translated into the pleasure principle. There's a slight different idea between our lust and the modern German lust. Our lust is largely sexual. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I did that with my fingers. Why did I do that with my fingers? Largely sexual.
But it's just like pleasure.
It's desire, but you can also, I mean, you can have lust auf tea. You know, I just feel like a tea. it's usually not sexual with tea.
This is a German romanticism thing, originally. The Wanderschaft is the traditional journeying period for journeymen as well, and that's kind of connected with the Wanderlust as well.
We've come across that ending of the word there, which is the equivalent to English ship, right?
Yes.
Wanderschaft, wandering ship, wander ship.
I forgot to mention a second ago with Weltschmerz, the second part, the Schmerz is the same as our word smart, basically. When something smarts and it's painful.
Oh, that's so good. I'd never spotted that.
Isn't
so,
that yeah, fun?
So Schmerz becomes smart, and Schwarz, which people maybe already know as the German for black, Old English used to have, and in Middle English used to have, the word swart for black, as well as black, because there were two different types of black. There's a sort of a shiny black, and then there's the sort of black that a deep hole is, for example. But we do still have that in the word swarthy.
That feels like an antiquated racist insult to me now.
Yeah, you have to be careful. Mostly. Yeah, I mean...
It feels a little like Victorian novel and Heathcliff-y, you know?
I can't think of a single situation where I would confidently use the word swarthy.
Right.
Except I mean, here.
I suppose it can have sort of a like piratey tone to it, but I don't know.
Yeah,
not so much.
Yeah, it could. I love how we're just stumbling across words here. I didn't have these words in my list at all. This is fantastic. I love it like this.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Bite into a stacked sandwich made with Hero Bread or a fully loaded bagel. And the only thing you'll think is, delicious. You won't think it's up to 19 grams of protein, but it is. You wouldn't believe it has 11 to 32 grams of fiber, but it does. Hero Bread makes loaves, buns, tortillas, bagels, and noodles packed with taste, but without all the net carbs. We're talking 0 to 5 grams net carbs per serving. With Hero Bread, there are no compromises, just flavor. There's none of the stiff baked goods you'd expect from better-for-you brands. There's just the soft, fluffy bread you crave. Plus, small batch drops of indulgent favorites, like the popular 2-gram net carb Hero Croissant and 3-gram net carb Hero Pain au Chocolat. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code IHEART at checkout. That's code IHEART at hero.co. All figures per serving of Hero Bread. See nutrition facts on hero.co.
You tried to take us over to German linguistic terms in English, and I would love to do that because one of my favorites is the fact that loan word is not a loan word, but it is a calc from the German Lehnwort, which means loan word. But if it were a loan word, then we would just use Lehnwort.
Right. So a calc is where you translate the elements into your language. Right. Whereas a borrowing would just be to take the German word.
Right, like cafe is a borrowing or a loan word, and then loan word is a calque. And calque is a French loan word, which means copy. It's from the verb calque, which means to trace by rubbing, which is also very cool, but that's a loan word from Italian.
I'm guessing calque is related to chalk, right? It's like a chalk rubbing, I think, as well. Anyway, lots of linguistic words. Who are the big influential people? Jakob Grimm, actually. Mm, the consonant shift I was describing earlier that takes High German away from Dutch and English, that's first sort of set out by, well, I don't know if it's first set out by him, but it's first certainly popularized, the idea is popularized by Jakob Grimm of the Brothers Grimm, who wrote all those fairy tales. Why are they collecting the fairy tales? Because I kind of just want to analyze them for language.
Ablaut, that's the word we're going in here. So Ablaut and Umlaut were given to us by But well, they're both older, but in the linguistic sense, Jacob Grimm is our guy here. So ablaut is this term for the regular pattern of vowel alternation that happens in a lot of Indo-European languages. And in German, it means like off sound or departing sound. And in English, we really got it from Franz Bopp in his comparative grammar, but Grimm made it a technical term in 1819. And so English does this with tenses like sing and sang and sung and song. And then, and one of the reasons that it comes up in Proto-Indo-European languages a lot is we tend to, this is a little technical, alternate among an E grade, an O grade, and a zero grade vowel, where the third time the vowel disappears or is reduced, which we see in like ride, rode, and ridden. The vowel there is doing these, and this comes up across many different languages. Meanwhile, we also have umlaut, which literally means changed sound or around sound.
Laut is just related to loud.
Yes, indeed. And that's the difference there is when it's also called an I mutation in English, when a vowel change, where a back vowel moves forward in the mouth or a front vowel becomes higher, like in man and men and foot and feet and goose and geese. You're anticipating a plural or inflectional ending that once contained an I sound that reshaped the preceding vowel and it's not there anymore.
Oh, that's why it's called an I mutation. That's brilliant. Mm-hmm. This is gloriously geeky. I'm well into
the
this.
The dot dots with the little dot dot with in German.
Yeah, which is one in German. It's not the same. It doesn't make the one in French is not the same. If you see the two dots above a vowel in French, it's called a tréma and it's doing something else. It's separating the two vowel sounds, whereas in German, it's altering the vowel sound, umlaut.
I think you mentioned before that it used to have a little E over it as well, and that kind of reflects the moving forward of the vowel sound.
If you can't find the two dots on your keyboard, or you just don't fancy writing them, you can just put an E after the vowel as an alternative to using the two dots, and it produces the same thing.
We tend to spell some like German names in English end up having like O-E in them.
Yeah, you sometimes meet people whose surname is Koenig, sometimes pronounced like Koenig, and that's K-O-E. But if you wanted to write it just straight up as King in German, which is what it's German for, you would pop an O with an umlaut above it.
My parents' best friends are the Schoenbergers, and that's how we say that in English, but it's got to be Schoenberg, right?
Yeah, Schoen is a really good example, yeah. Beautiful. That's beautiful. The beautiful mountain and I get a bit confused because Berg can mean a hill, but a Berger can be sort of a person from somewhere.
I would assume.
Or is that B-U-R-G-E-R?
From a place called Schoenberg. That would be my guess.
Someone just needs to explain this one in the comments to me. I'm getting my Bergs and my Borgs confused, I think. Anyway, I think, yeah, someone from a pretty mountain would, I guess, be a Schoenberger.
A couple more little sort of linguistic terms. A van der Voort is a migratory term or word that would be one that is basically the same in many different languages, like chai or tea, basically the same word in lots of different languages, ginger, copper, silver, mint, honey, things like that. And it's usually like something that got traded. Another one is the leitmotif, which is, it's a musical phrase, but I think you could also use it in literature as well. It means leading motive, and it was associated with Wagnerian musical drama. But Mozart also used leitmotifs as well.
The arts, we didn't really even go into the arts, did we? I mean, you have the Bildungsroman, which is...
We're already here. We have arrived in the arts.
Yeah, there we are. Bildungs is sort of development, or I mean, you could think of it as buildings, but it's not quite the same. How would you translate Bildungsroman? There's like a straight up English translation of that, isn't there?
It's like education novel. I mean, it's a coming of age story in English.
That's it. There we go. That's what I'm talking about. Coming of age story. That's what I was looking for. Nice one.
I kind of failed to explain in our Latin episode why romance became a word for stories. Romance first meant a work written in French, and French works were long tales of like legendary history and adventure. And then Germanic languages like English and German started using it for kind of any sort of courtly story, because the works in the French vernacular often featured kings and knights and wars and conquests and love and marvels, romance shifted from a work in French to any adventure story, and then ultimately one that involved courtly love.
So that Bildungsroman is actually a mix of German and French.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff.
Oh, can I return to a hypothesis I made earlier, which was that there are more German words in sort of everyday use in America. One of the other words that made me think of that, I'm trying to steer us in the direction of the research I've been doing, is kindergarten.
Yeah, good call.
Because we call it a nursery school commonly in Britain. We don't call it a kindergarten pretty much at all.
Interesting.
Unless you go to what was a descendant of the original kindergartens.
So like a German school?
Yeah, it would have to be one that was established by the successors to Friedrich Froebel, the inventor of the kindergarten, who is a guy who was born in 1782. It's like really ages ago. He fought in two wars against Napoleon, this man. But he also had a tragic start in life. His mother never really recovered from childbirth, and she died when I think he was about 9 months old. And his dad wasn't really up to the job of filling the void, so he sought.
He was like, I will parent all children behalf.
More or less, he sought, as a child, he sought solace in nature, but he came to believe that humans, as a part of nature themselves, could learn a great deal from nature. And so he does eventually establish the Kindergarten, which is the actual plural of kindergarten. It's not kindergartens, Kindergarten, with a nice umlaut on that A. And they start off just in Germany, but they get banned by the Kingdom of Prussia. A lot of the people that are staffing them that are teaching at the Kindergarten are forced to flee, and they flee to places like Britain and America, and they set up kindergartens there. And in America, it becomes the generic term for preschool education, because it's one of the things that Friedrich Froebel believed was that kids weren't being developed sufficiently before they got to school. They're sort of holistically.
The first kindergarten in the US was started in Watertown, Wisconsin, by a German lady.
Did she perhaps flee as well?
I imagine so. This was 1856, so that would make sense. And that was a German language kindergarten. Elizabeth Peabody founded the first English language kindergarten in 1860 in Boston, and then spread sort of Boston being a hub for educational, like pedagogy, kind of across the US in general.
But what we've neglected to even point out is what kindergarten means.
Children garden.
It seems a little bit obvious. It means children garden. But it doesn't mean that necessarily for the reason that I think you could assume. You might assume that it's a garden where children play, but actually Friedrich Froebel was very explicit when he put out his first adverts looking for people to help about why it was called a kindergarten. And it was that it was a place where children grow and flourish like flowers, which is actually way more poetic than I'd always assumed it was.
It's a little more like Montessori style is the idea that I seem to get out of it, which is that like it's focused on self-expression and self-directed learning through play and songs and practical activities.
Kids that attended a kindergarten were given what became known as Froebel's gifts, which were little, very simple toys, like, I don't know, a load of blocks, a fixed number of blocks, or a ball and a prism or something. And they were encouraged to let their imagination go wild. Nothing they did with it was wrong. Maybe not sticking it in the eye of the next child over. but otherwise, you're right. It was about a freedom of expression above all else. It's still going. The movement is still going, which is why I mentioned that to go to a kindergarten in Britain, you might actually have to go to one of the original sort of styled kindergarten. But we don't just call generally nursery school a kindergarten.
One of the things that you can bring to school or kindergarten is a backpack. And we have three words from German for different kinds of backpacks. We have rucksack, knapsack, and haversack, which is your back sack. Ruck is related to the English word ridge, which is also just the word for a back, ultimately. It's from the Old English word for your back.
I didn't know that it was related to ridge. You're throwing all these out for me. That's amazing. Then I don't think that's an obvious one at all.
I don't think so either.
Other than they only got one letter in common.
Yeah, and in Old English, it was ridge was spelled H-R-Y-C-G. So,
yeah, that makes more sense.
So we've got the rucksack, which is the back sack, the knapsack, which is the eating sack, napping to eat, and literally to crack or snap, though, I think is the napping, which we've talked about before. And when did we talk about that?
We talked about knackig, and we were talking about sausages.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm also thinking of the fact that a knockwurst is called a knockwurst.
Oh, yeah. Maybe this is just a little different.
In English, but it's a knockwurst in German. Point is that we tend to not pronounce the K. Is there a K at the start of knapsack, though?
Yes. So it would be knapsack.
Yeah, exactly. There we go.
That's your eating
sack. We tend to
assume
that they're silent like they are in English, but they're not in German.
But your haversack, which is also from German, is also an eating sack because it means oat sack.
Oh, okay. So it's like if you want oat milk, you have Hafermilch.
Ooh, that's fun. Yeah. But yeah, originally it was a word for a bag for oats that you would carry, like a horse oat bag.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's really good. I learned a cute one the other day. Well, it wasn't that I learned the word. I obviously knew that the word muesli, as in like breakfast cereal, was German. But what I didn't know is that it's Swiss German and that it's actually quite adorable because the Li is one of these regional diminutive suffixes. Basically, you stick it on the end of something to make it sound cute, like the line on the end of Fräulein means little one, the Schön on the end of Mädchen or Wörtchen means little, but muesli means little muss, must being like a sludge.
A bit of morning sludge.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't have cute words for sludgy stuff, unfortunately.
No. I mean, it's related to our word mush.
That also just doesn't sound as cute as muesli. I hadn't even heard of it until like IKEA came to town when I was a kid.
Oh, really? Ah, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing is in England, we use muesli to refer to quite a specific type of breakfast cereal, a collection of oats and maybe some dried fruit in there. But here I've noticed that muesli is used for much more sort of broadly for breakfast cereals of any time type.
Yeah, it struck me when I first tried it. I was like, this is like less sugary granola.
That's what it is. It's misery granola, basically.
Misery granola. Sad granola.
Sad granola. Oh, is it granola? Oh, it's muesli. Oh. I've got us onto food. We should talk about food, obviously, because that's a really good way that we smuggle German words into English.
We all know the most fun one of these.
Go on.
Pumpernickel.
Pumpernickel. Yeah, that is a fun one.
Yes, it means fart goblin or fart devil.
It's the same nickel as in the name of the metal.
And because Nicholas has also often been associated with like goblins and the devil, we also have records of the devil being called Old Nick in English too.
Yeah, it's quite common. It still gets called Old Nick sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But then we have foods that we think of as like really sort of American, like the hamburger. I think of that. If you sort of name an American food, I'd think of the hamburger, even though it literally just means thing from Hamburg in Germany. And to say the Frankfurter is the thing from Frankfurt, and the Wiener is the thing from Vienna.
The hamburger is one of our re-bracketing bits because like all burgers are named after Hamburg.
Yeah, even a beef burger or a cheeseburger is named after Hamburg.
I've never had a burger
there
with
is no
ham
cheeseburger.
In it.
This is true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I grew up thinking that beef burgers and hamburgers must somehow be different because in shops, they're sold as beef burgers.
Are they?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I remember distinctly seeing packaging in like Iceland, this frozen food shop in England that said beef burgers.
Sometimes they're branded as beef burgers here, but they're all made of, well, unless they're specified otherwise, they're made of beef.
You have a chicken burger. There is no chicken burger.
There's no chicken burger. Turkey burger, that kind of thing. No turkey burger.
Where do you come from? Chicken burger. Sauerkraut, that's a good one. A lot of them are just very literal descriptions. Sauerkraut is just
sour cabbage.
Yeah, exactly. And schnitzel is a cut. Schneiden is the verb to cut.
We got noodle from German as well.
Yeah, it's a weird one, that, isn't it? Because again, do not associate the food with Germany at all. But it seems like that's where we got it from.
It might be related to the, like, a word for dumpling, right? And therefore related to the word knot.
Yeah, I have Knödel, which is kind of dumpling. There are various words that are a little bit like noodle that mean a kind of doughy thing. In Germany, Knödel means pasta, not specifically what we would call noodles. Even if you get like Fusilli, that's Nudeln still.
Noodle.
Yeah, noodles.
I did not know until I was looking this up the other day that we got the word and the concept of gummy bears from German, which makes perfect sense because of Haribo.
Oh, Haribo again is one of those brand names that's just made up of the first syllable of names. I've forgotten his name. What is it?
Hans Riegel Sr. founded Haribo in Bonn. So it's
Hans Riegel Bonn. Very good. Oh, I like that. Yeah, and it says Gummibärchen on the German packet of those lovely, what do they call them in English? They call them star bears or something, don't they? No, that's star mix.
Gold bears?
Gold bears. Goldbeeren. That's what it says, not Gummibären. Yeah, you're right.
I actually do have one more. Pretzels. Pretzels were from German.
Oh, this is a very good one. This is really, really interesting.
Because it's also Latin and it means like folded arms.
This is the best theory, right? Because we've never seen this word brachiatellos that it potentially comes from. In Latin, which would mean like, yeah, folded arms, but that would link it to words like brachiosaurus, right? It means arm lizard, pretzel. Yeah, I actually do. I was going to make a little video about this, and I bought a tiny brachiosaurus. And I've also eaten pretzels since, but I've never managed to have the two things in the same place to make the little short that I wanted to make about this very thing. One day I will.
One day will you have little...
When we were talking about what we were going to discuss on the show, we mentioned dog breeds. We should go down there because I was like, why do we have so many dog breeds that have German names? And you conjectured something about it.
I did. And I actually looked this up a little bit more. There are more like English and French names for dog breeds in English, but Germany is still up there. And reading about it, it seems to be that it's kind of a combination of several breeders in Germany kind of picking up dog breeding around the same time. And it coincides with the Industrial Revolution shifting away from the need for working dogs, so you get more pet dogs. There was an era in which dog breeders, like the person who first bred German Shepherds, whose name was Max von Steffenitz, a lot of shepherding dogs in Germany were just kind of whatever dog you had. Like that was, there was no standardization around the breed. And so he wanted more herding dogs to be more standardized like English herding dogs, but he particularly liked dogs with a wolf-like appearance and pointy ears who were also intelligent, had sharp senses, and a strong willingness to work. And that became the German Shepherd. That same dog is also called an Alsatian, which you may have heard, because during World War I, the British wanted to not say the word German.
That's right, yeah. Alsatia is, well, it's Alsace, right, in France, although they speak a language there called Alsatian, which is a form of High German. Splitting hairs, really. I mean, that region has changed hands between Germany and France over and over again. But the dog is not from Alsace, by the way. It was just to avoid calling it a German Shepherd.
They became known as Alsatian wolf dogs for a short time. And now you still see it sometimes, but mostly they're called German Shepherds.
Here's one that we don't get from German, but is worth mentioning. Well, it will become clear. Yeah, a Great Dane. Do you know what it's called in German?
What's it called?
It's called a Deutsche Dogge.
So it has the English word dog.
Yeah, it's called a German dog. We talked before about how the English word dog doesn't seem to have any relations in other languages. So we can be pretty confident, well, we know that that is a borrowing of the English word dog. But dog tends to be used in other languages for a very specific type of dog. And a Great Dane is that type of dog. Is
big
one of
dogs.
Those, yeah,
tend to
big
be
dogs, sort of mm-hmm. bloodhounds and
mastiffs and what things. Have
you. Mastiffs, that's the word. That's the thing. Yeah, mastiffs tend to be called dogs in other languages. But yeah, in German, what we call the Great Dane, they call the German dog, which is confusing.
Poodle, that's a puddle dog, basically. It means a water dog. And then the Schnauzer, which is the snarler or growler.
I have to mention that in Berlin, so people who like to criticize Berlin as an unfriendly place, because sometimes it really is, they talk about the Berliner Schnauzer, which means the German snout, but it's basically the sort of grumpy attitude that, that Berliners conduct themselves with. And that is the same as you found in the name of the dog. We say Schnauzer, but it would be Schnauzer.
Yeah, it means like the word is like snout or muzzle, but it can also mean like growler or snarler with your snout.
Yeah, with your snout. Rottweiler is just a thing from Rottweil. Shall we work out what that meant, though? Rottweil. Weil is like villa in Latin, which didn't mean a house. It meant a farm, really. And the Rott might be red, but it might not be.
Oh, yeah. No, I did see that once. I researching this for something else, it suggested maybe it was the color of the brick in the town, like the roads. But the Rottweil butcher's dog is the translation of like the original name of the dog. So they were used to guard livestock and drive cattle and then even pull carts loaded with meat.
It's a shortening in much the way that you might call we haven't even mentioned that the dollar, the word dollar comes from German.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Joachim's Thaler. Yeah, Joachim's Thaler. Joachim's Thaler is the Joachim Valley, where they mined and minted big coins. Long story, very short. And the Joachim's Thaler becomes just a Thaler, and then that travels and eventually becomes dollar. I'm sure we went into that at some point when we talked about money.
I think so too.
Oh, and we should mention that Neanderthal as well comes from the Neander Valley.
We've talked about dachshund before, but it's a badger hound because they used to go down the badger holes.
Hunt after badgers. Doberman's not what you expect because it's not, well, it's named after a person. Carl Friedrich Louis Doberman, who is a breeder.
Famous for pinching. Not really. Pincher was the word for a terrier type dog, which it is related to the word pinch. Their little nipping was pinchy.
Off the back of Doberman, I want to just mention some things that are actually named after German people, or at least people with German names. So we have Diesel, which is named after Rudolf Diesel, who developed it. Zeppelin, Ferdinand von Zeppelin, German name. The Bunsen burner is named after Robert Bunsen. And the Geiger counter is named after Hans Geiger. What else have we got?
Fahrenheit, surely.
Fahrenheit. Yeah, Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit. And Hertz is from Heinrich Hertz. The Doppler effect is from the Austrian physicist Christian Doppler. I put on a little French accent there. And Möbius strip is August Ferdinand Möbius.
Mesmerize is from Franz Anton Mesmer. He was a proponent of animal magnetism, which also involved hypnotizing people.
Yeah. He had his theory taken off him very early by charlatans.
Yes.
Used his name repeatedly to say things that were not what he thought. It's a bit of one of history's losers, unfortunately, is Mr. Mesmer.
I would love to cover some German given names that go really hard in terms of like if you translate them into English, in German, they're just really badass.
Okay. I have no idea like, where you're going with this. Go on.
Well, okay. Like Ludwig means like famous in war. Lud is related to loud. Hedwig, which is war or struggle, which is a fun one. Hilda is battle maid, and it's also related to Hildebrand, which is battle sword. And the brand in it is related to our word brandish as well. It's also related to the word brand, because brand, the root of brand, and all of these words that are similar that mean sword mean burning. But it also resulted in a lot of words for swords.
Brandfall is still the word for a a house fire here. Brand is fire.
I guess the flashing of the sword perhaps resulted in many words in a variety of languages that are similar and mean sword. There's also Brunhild, which means battle ready in armor or armor battle. And then Matilda, which means mighty in battle and has the Hilda bit in it as well. In Old English, we also used Hild in a bunch of kennings. Hildbed was your deathbed. And then a Hilde Jisikl, which was like blood dripping from a sword, but it meant battle icicle, which is very cool. It's like the cold steel. And then Hildenadder, which was a war adder, but a word for an arrow or a lance or a spear.
So these are kennings. So these are the words that sort of turn up
in like poetry. And what, yeah.
They don't necessarily stick around. They're kind of
no, but they're like metaphorical extensions of these things, which is fun. They're very poetic. You could also be Hildesad, which is weary of fighting, or literally battle sad.
Yeah, well, but sad in that sense is the German sense of sat, which is fed up, as in like satiated, full up, rather than sad.
Sad. A couple more German names. The name Albert and then Albrecht means noble, bright, which is very cool. And then Bertha, similarly, is the bright one, which is cool and has German variations. Bernard or Bernard in various languages is a German name originally. It means bold as a bear.
But there are equivalents of a lot of these in Old English, weren't there? And also French. Like my name, Robert. The Bert at the end of any name is from that same word meaning bright in German, but also it meant it in Old English because the languages were very closely related, which brings us nicely full circle, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Vielen Dank, Jess. This was a lot of spaß. That means fun. Doesn't sound like it means fun, but it does.
This was an excellent time. I'm very glad we did the subject.
We'll catch you in the next Words Unraveled. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Ciao.
We'll see you then.
Tschüssi.
Hey guys, it's Ashley Canetti from the Ben and Ashley I Almost Famous podcast. My friend said this once and I have adopted it as my own. She goes, I'm not a crunchy mom, but I'm a crispy mom. And I'm like, that is me too. Like, of course we're going to have our junk food days, but primarily when we're eating inside the house, I am very particular about what I buy and make for my kids because sometimes, you know, like for example, they're going to eat chicken nuggets, right? They're going to eat macaroni and cheese. But I'm trying to find the best possible versions of those. And in order to do that, I use this really great app when I'm grocery shopping. It's called Wise Code. And it's basically an ultra processed food detector. All you do is scan a product to instantly see if it's ultra processed. They go beyond the label. You're able to view nutrition quality and health quality. It makes grocery shopping easy. It helps you make more informed decisions for your family. It's available on the App Store. I love, love, love it. It is exactly what a crispy mom needs. You can download Wise Code, the ultra processed food detector, on the App Store today.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons, from tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond. Every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Think about it. When it comes to your own food, you can walk into a restaurant, see what's being made, and know exactly what you're getting. But with dog food, most brands keep that completely hidden. Just Food for Dogs does the opposite. They've built their entire brand around open kitchens. You can actually walk in and watch them prepare your dog's meals with real human-grade ingredients like chicken, beef, carrots, and peas, cooked right there in front of you. No mystery, no behind the scenes you're not allowed to see. That kind of transparency is rare in the pet food world. And it's a big reason they've become the number one vet-recommended fresh dog food. earning trust from pet parents who want to feel confident in what they're feeding. When a brand is willing to show you exactly how your dog's food is made, it says a lot about the care, quality, and standards behind every meal they produce. Nothing to hide, everything to love. Go to justfoodfordogs.com and get 50% off your first order.